The most unappreciated TV supporting characters on television, TV crossover ideas, and our Stephen King movie battle royale. Get ready. This is the best of The Hollywood Outsider 2019, Volume 2. I'm your host, Aaron Peterson, and you might have noticed we are off. Amanda Sink and John Davenport are enjoying the Labor Day week festivities, and we are not currently producing a new episode this week, but that doesn't mean you don't get anything. So what we are doing is we have procured several of our most popular topics from earlier in the year. It's the greatest hits package, basically. Just the nuggets of what people loved from Hollywood Outsider earlier this year. Remember, you can subscribe in whatever podcast app you use, and you can support the show at patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. That's patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider, where our fall movie preview is already up and tons of other bonus content. I'm going to get right into it. I'm not going to waste any of your time. Let's just get to the hits, and we will be back next week. We're going to talk about our fears that movies and television have forced us to deal with in good ways and bad. As well as, of course, It Chapter 2. All right, let's get into it. And on our Stephen King spoiler cast, you will notice that Troy Heinrichs from the Blacklist Exposed podcast joins us so we can do our movie battle royale properly, as we always like to have four hosts present. Okay, without further ado, here are three of our most popular topics from the first half of the year. TV crossovers we need, the Stephen King movie battle royale, and the most unappreciated supporting characters in television, which is where we are going to start now. From the outside in topic, unappreciated TV supporting actors. This week, we are talking about the little guys and gals who make our favorite shows hum. Yet nobody seems to want to talk about them. A lot less people talk about them than they do the Tyrions, the Jessies, the Ron Swansons. If you already hear their name mentioned in everyday conversation, they're not really unappreciated, are they? So we're talking about those characters on television. It wasn't really a question. We're talking about those characters on television that people seem to forget are instrumental in the show's success. First, can a supporting actor make or break a TV show, in your opinion, John?
Certainly. Like, you just brought up several. Tyrion, who went from being a supporting to he's a lead now. The Jessies, same thing. Ron Swanson's. Like, these characters and these actors behind them are able to make something that's small and turn it into something huge. Not only Ron Swanson, but there's also Andy Dwyer, who went from being the goofball ex-boyfriend of one of the characters in Parks and Rec to now he's freaking Star-Lord. Come on now. Yeah, totally. They can totally make or break a show. And yeah, and you're usually my favorite part, too.
Can they make a show where you don't like the lead actors, though? Can you, I mean, I guess I want to like build on that. Can a show survive if you aren't into the leads, but the supporting actors are that good?
Well, Breaking Bad is a good example of that because.
What? No, it's not.
Hear me out.
You're wrong before you finish.
You're
okay.
High.
As much as I like Bryan Cranston, I did not like Walter White. Like, he was somebody I did not want to spend time with. I was a little bit bored and tired with him to begin with.
But he's still a compelling character the entire time.
Well, he's a compelling character, but not easy to like at all. So if it wasn't for Jesse and his interactions with Jesse, I would not have been able to stick it out and to a point where I really appreciated Walter White by the end.
That's okay. True.
I will be quiet.
Yeah.
Amanda, we're both wrong.
Well, I agree with what he said now. I'm not saying he's wrong
at the
end.
Yeah, but we were wrong at the beginning. So is where we say it. Come on. No, I was wrong.
You were wrong.
She's incapable of these words, John, in case you haven't noticed. Incapable of those words.
So my answer to this is they can absolutely make or break a show. And so much so that the showrunners often realize this. When there's a beloved character that was not intended to stay onto the show, the showrunners are like, wow, fans really love this person. Let's write them in. Give them a continue story arc. A good example that's just at the top of my head is with Ryan Hansen from Veronica Mars, who plays Dick. He was not supposed to have more than just a cameo, and he was written through the entire show. He's in the revival. He was in the movie. Like, he is a very significant part of the show, and that happens like quite often. Where they
Boyd Crowder and Justified, same thing. He was supposed to be killed off in the first episode, became the number one villain the whole show.
Those people can really, I mean, they can stand out, and the showrunners can be like, wow, you deserve way more of a chance because people love you so much. They love you more than anybody else on the show. And that gives them a chance to kind of stand out and, in a way, is making that show better. John gave a perfect example that we were both not 100% correct on at first, which was Jesse with Breaking Bad. He makes Walter White who he is. And those, I think, are the best supporting characters, the ones who are able to build your main lead cast into something even better by their presence being there.
I'll give you my best example I could think of. Alex P. Keaton from Family Ties. You take Michael J. Fox out of that show, nobody cares. Nobody cares about Family Ties. Everybody loved that show that I'm aware of because Michael J. Fox was so good in it. And if it wasn't for his role, which he was 100% a supporting character, and they just ended up giving him like every freaking plot point after a certain season because they realized, well, people only watch because of Michael J. Fox. They started amping up his performance and he became a lead, but he was 100% a supporting character. And that was like, I was trying to think of like make or break shows that were made or broken by a supporting actor. 100% Michael J. Fox came to mind.
It's kind of like that. That's kind of like the same idea behind The Simpsons. When The Simpsons was more about the kids, sure, it lasted for a while, but it didn't start really getting good until it became more about Homer.
Mm, that's true. I mean, but he's the kind of lead, though, isn't he?
He wasn't necessarily the lead before because it was more
about Bart,
the kids.
Yeah. Okay.
And more about what they did and what they couldn't get away with as being kids. But when it became more about Homer and his daily life and how he's, you know, it became a better show and more interesting.
All right. So how do you define unappreciated? Before we get to our picks for our three most unappreciated, how do you define unappreciated? For example, give us a TV series that you had a hard time getting into, but the supporting actor is the one that kept you invested. And how did they accomplish that, I guess?
So the one that comes to mind is one of the few shows that I cannot stand, but I will get through it because of this supporting character, and that is Seinfeld. I hate that show.
What?
I do not like it. I don't find it funny. The only times I laugh are when it's Elaine. Elaine in the moments makes me laugh. She is, and this is probably one of the only shows that I've really ever been very anti-watching. Aside from Frasier, I don't like Frasier either. I know.
But it's such a smart show.
I don't like it. I don't find it compelling.
So you just like dumb comedy is what I'm getting.
But these characters can help make you, even though there were reruns constantly, even when it went off the air. And still at that point, I didn't turn the TV off if the episode was featuring her.
What about her was the hook?
I think it was just having somebody who made me laugh. Her comedy made me laugh more than their comedy did. And the way she interacted with them, I was like, okay, if she were not in the show, I would not care about the show. I wouldn't care about the other characters. I wouldn't be able to invest in them at all. She just somehow was like the glue that kept them together for me.
She's my favorite too.
Yeah,
Kramer's crazy, but
he's so
not,
off the wall.
He's
dude,
not a
I
character.
Can't handle it. I cannot.
Hey, Joey!
Oh my god. But that's the only reason why I was able to watch episodes is because of her. And, you know, it could, for me too, it could have just been like, oh, this is the only identifiable character for me as like a woman. Like, I could not get on board with Kramer. Seinfeld, like, he was okay, but I mean, he was still.
And George Costanza is just the biggest douche on the planet.
He's so dumb too. But so she okay. was definitely the one for me.
Good. Johnny, what about you? You got any you can think of off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, the one that came up first, and to give some background on this, when CW or WB or whatever channel it is these days, because I don't have cable anymore, so I don't know what it's called, they came out with the current iteration of the DC shows. A certain podcast host, I think his name was Aaron, said that Arrow was a really good show to watch, or at least he was enjoying it. So I was like, you know what? Aaron digs it. I should sit down and try to watch this. And I did. And though it was cool, I really didn't find anything in it that caught my attention until Felicity Smoke showed up. Because Emily Bette Richards just plays her in such a a joyous and fun way that is, it's, it, she lights up a screen whenever she's on the screen, and she really brings a lot of light to a show that was trying, at least at the time, to be very dour and dark. She's always there to make it an easier time, and she's just so much fun to watch on screen. So that's what I think of when I think of somebody who's can make or break a show, for sure.
That's a good one, especially because you referenced me, and I like that.
Oh boy. The two of you and your egos today.
Just kidding. Thank you. That was very nice.
No, he's not.
No, it was very nice. Thank you. That concept for me is solidified by my favorite comedy of all time, which is Night Court. And the first season, I mean, if people have listened to the show, or you haven't listened very often, maybe you're just one of the newer listeners because you caught the summer movie preview and
how many times are you going to plug
Avengers
that today?
Avengers Endgame spoiler cast.
Call
we
back.
Put a lot of work into that. I want people to make sure they listen to it. All right. So when the first season came, I don't like sitcoms, is what I was trying to get to. I've never been a big sitcom guy. I guffaws and, you know, a lot of that humor just doesn't work for me. It doesn't really make me laugh. And, you know, I'm obviously wounded as a person. I get it. When I was a kid, I remember when Night Court came on, and everybody was talking about Cheers, and everybody was talking about all these other shows. And the first season of Night Court came on, I didn't find it that funny at the time. You know, going back, I like it more now, but I didn't like it at the time. And I remember coming back to it because I really liked the character of Dan Fielding, because he was a sexist, misogynistic, just rascal, I guess was the term back in the 80s, just a pig, douche, and hilarious. Everything he said was just to demean somebody else. And that's my kind of humor. I really respected it at the time, because you can't do that anymore. Now it's insensitive. Now it's, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But nobody was saved. Nobody was clear. Nobody was. He would make fun of little people. He would make fun of women, races, genders. He
I don't
didn't
think they
care.
Like little people as a term.
I didn't know what today's term is. I'm sorry.
He was House before House.
Yeah, he was way worse than House. House is a freaking walk in the park compared to Dan Fielding. And here he was, this character on TV. He was like Archie Bunker for Night Court. And the first season was all about Harry. It was really focused on Harry. And I came to love Harry, but I didn't like him that first season. I just felt like, yeah, it's just not that great a show. Just focused on this guy. I mean, I just don't find him as endearing. The second season, they really amped up Dan Fielding, and it just made the show great. You know, everything else, all the crazy bonkers stuff that goes on in the background, yes, all that stuff's fun. And he added to it. But he makes every scene pop. There's a reason why he won so many Emmys. He stopped allowing himself to be considered because he felt it was unfair to the other actors in the supporting actor category. He removed himself from contention because he's too good. That's a fact.
It's like he was Aaron before Aaron was there.
No, I'm serious, though. He was that good. He took himself out of, that's a fact. Go look it up. That actor made that show my favorite comedy of all time. You take him out of it, I don't want anything to do with it. I mean, I still probably would watch a few of them, but I would not have been as hooked as I was. And they did eventually give him, you know, actual characteristics and made him a person, humanized him to a degree, but he never lost that edge of being Dan Fielding, which is the pig who will say anything. And I love the guy.
Dan Fielding was one of my favorite characters, too. Dan Fielding and Bull, if I could run a gambit to opposite ends of the spectrums, those are my two favorites from that show.
It is a good show, but one thing we did not talk about, which was the initial question, is how do we define unappreciated?
Oh, how do we...
Like, how do we define it, which was your question, which none of us talked about.
That's true. We just gave the examples of how a supporting actor kind of overwhelmed... to me, because he didn't win the Emmys until later in the show. It's a unappreciated mean. It's a character who keeps you engaged when the show isn't. When the show loses you, it's a character that, to me, I mean, or it can be a character who reinvigorates you in a show you already loved.
Right. Well, Andy Dwyer and Ron Swanson are perfect examples of that from Parks and Rec, especially that very first season, which if you talk to anybody and they say, hey, you need to watch Parks and Rec, and they'll also give you that little bit of a nod saying, maybe start with season two. Andy Dwyer and Ron Swanson get you through season one. Which is only 8 episodes or six or eight.
Yeah, it's like 8 episodes long. It's not that long of a first season. But I will be honest, I skipped that. I did like the first 2 episodes and I said, I'm not doing this. And I skipped to the almost end of the second season because I was like, I'm not going to get through the show if I don't. And so I skipped it. And then I went back and rewatched those episodes.
Well, you made us go back. What's your version of Unappreciated?
Well, I have a few.
I just ignored my own question.
Yeah, right. I have a few of them. So it can.
Of course you do.
Right. It can be somebody who does not get any respect or talked about or isn't loved, of course. You know, that's a very generic unappreciated definition. But it can also be, like you guys said, somebody who is beloved by the fans but doesn't get the critical attention that they deserve or the critics' attention that they deserve. And it can also be somebody that people like, but they don't give them enough credit of how much they actually make the show what the show is, how much their character is integral to the value of the show and the continuation of the show, and even the lead casting.
Right.
Without that character, there would not be a significant show. There wouldn't be a conclusion. One of my characters, her value in the show is the entire reason we were even able to get a conclusion. Without her, none of that would have happened. She was absolutely necessary.
You'll get to talk about your purse when we
get
there.
But I'm just trying to give an example of how that...
I feel like you're dangerously approaching the honorable mention category, and we're not doing that.
No, it's the same character I'm going to talk about.
All right. John, you felt that honorable mention thing coming on.
I don't have an honorable mention. I don't have one.
It felt a little...
I don't have one.
Not now, because we shut it down.
You can't shut it down when it never happened.
Well, we shut it down. That's why it didn't happen.
Yeah, that's what's shutting it down.
No, it didn't happen because I didn't have anything honorably
because
mentioned.
We shut it down.
Oh, no.
Supporting TV has a litany of classic characters that people rave about to this day. Norm, George Costanza, Sheldon, Zoe, the list goes on and on. But this is about the lesser, more unappreciated ones. Let's see what you have. Who are your top three most unappreciated TV supporting characters in TV? And why do you think audiences never quite appreciated them?
So the first one I came up with was Astrid from Fringe. And the reason why I chose her over, let's say, like Walter Bishop is because, yeah, sure, that everyone would go to Walter Bishop to save the day or to figure out a problem. But Astrid was the one that made Walter work the most because with the two of them behaving back and forth, with the two of them, like he never got her name right, that sorts of things, it gave Walter the chance to be more of a character versus just the answer man. And by her character being there, it helped improve him to a degree. So she's underappreciated because she literally is the reason why Walter works and nobody knows that.
He really never got her name right that entire series. Yeah. Astro. The one that you figure it wouldn't be that hard to get that name right eventually, because how many options can there be? Turns out hundreds. That's a good one. All right, we'll do one. Yeah, go ahead.
The one that I was just talking about is the first one I'm going to discuss here, which is Willow from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Okay.
She is...
Now, some could argue she's already popular.
Let me get there. All right. She is a character that people like, that people enjoy, that people respect. But she is not a character that is seen as the reason the show survived. And I don't even mean necessarily in you being able to continue to watch it, although she did have that. She was granted one of the only characters who had a very significant character arc in one of the seasons that it was focused on her.
Mm-hmm.
And Xander didn't get that. Xander had a side story that we followed. He didn't have an entire season devoted to him where she did. But the reason I say that is Buffy would not be here if it weren't for Willow. The world would not be saved if it weren't for Willow. The world wouldn't be saved a second time if it weren't for Willow. Every time there was something that happened, Buffy always had Giles by her and she always had Xander. And they were very integral parts to her success as well. But they always got that credit. Willow was never credited as she saved the world. And she damn did. She is the one who helped she's the one who brought Buffy back. She's the one who did all of the magic to make every season work.
Should have called it Willow, the Witch Slayer.
I mean, she really did. She did not physically kill every zombie, but she made it so, or zombie, vampire. She made it so Buffy could continue her success.
I was watching a totally different show. Puts it in a new context.
The Willow Dead.
Yeah.
But she's the one who helped Buffy get her success. And if Buffy didn't have Willow, she would not emotionally be stable or alive in that capacity. nor would she be physically alive and capable of doing the things she did.
Well done. All right. Sold me. I was not on board with Willow because I figured she was too popular, but I get what you're saying now. All right. I'm going to try the same approach in one of mine. My other two are much, much less known, but Chloe O'Brien from 24. Here's a character I thought I wouldn't be able to include because I live in 24 or lower. I mean, I love that show. It's one of my favorite shows of all time. I figure she must be hugely appreciated. Nope. I was researching supporting characters and her name just did not come up. And I looked at a lot. I'm like, why isn't she in more most popular supporting characters or, you know, supporting, you know, just anything where it says this character made the show better? Because she did. Mary Lynn Rescub took a character who debuted, I believe, in season 3 as a raging wench nobody could stand and made her like the most integral part of Jack Bauer's day. Every season, the character stole every single scene she was in, never failed to not annoy the shit out of everybody watching at the same time. Also, she's right there figuring out how to get Jack Bauer out of whatever legal conundrum he's encountered, how to get him through the stairwell, how to make him do whatever Jack Bauer was going to do, how to shoot that guy in the face and get away with it, whatever. She's always there to help him. And she's the quintessential know-it-all you hate to love. That's Chloe O'Brien. But she was never, apparently, by the public, as appreciated as she should have been. Maybe
no, she was, diehard fan. She really wasn't. When you mentioned her earlier today, and you were like, I don't know if it counts, I definitely felt like it did, because in the group of friends in which I watched 24 with, half of them hated him, half of them loved her. But, you know, as far as like who she was, there wasn't an episode from the time that she showed up to the time that she left the show that you didn't have Jack Bauer going, I need the schematics, Chloe!
Get me in! Hide the secret! Lie! And she did it all.
She was kind of like his puppeteer. Like, she was the one able to pull all the strings to make everything happen for him.
He's not getting there to save that guy if Chloe O'Brien's not there. Very unappreciated. John, who's your number two?
My number two is Ward Meacham from Iron Fist.
Hmm.
He's a weird one to pick, I'm sure, but hear me out.
Don't really have a choice, John. It's a podcast.
Oh, right. I keep forgetting that. Iron Fist is unfortunately a show that it has had a very blah first season, had a fairly good second season. But how do you get through that very, very blah first season? Well, you have a great section of supporting characters that keep you interested. And Ward was the top of the list. He, as far as like somebody who is going through a lot of things, and as far as watching somebody, the actor behind Ward, who is Tom Pelfrey, go through the steps of creating that character, he made somebody who was so much more interesting to watch than Danny was that you really wanted to stick with it. And then by the second season, watching the way Danny and Ward were interacting as Flynn, because he doesn't have the job anymore. as he got better, Ward got even better with him, and it was fun to watch the show that they could have developed as the Danny and Ward go off on a buddy cop comedy. He really just made that show for me, and I am brokenhearted that I won't be able to see that.
That's interesting, because you picked one from a show that a lot of people don't like, but I would agree, he was one of the more entertaining parts of that show.
Yeah, no, he really was. He really did make the show.
My second one is Lewis Litt from Suits.
Such a dick.
He is a dick, but he's the one who keeps you.
Fun dick.
Yeah, he's the one that brings the comedy. I mean, you have Harvey and everything, and that's all great. But Lewis is also the one that continues to help reinvent the plot, because he always does something really stupid that Harvey has to fix.
And Suits, yeah.
Yeah, he's the one that, I mean, we love to hate him. He's one of those characters, but he's enjoyable to watch. His presence elevates the entire show to me, because I'm like, this asshole again.
And he makes every situation worse.
He does.
Every situation worse. He's a horrible lawyer. But he's a great lawyer.
Yeah, which is so great, because it helps, like I said, it helps make the plot a little bit more interesting, because it creates new problems that need solving, but it has some subtlety. Like, you can expect it. You expect something to go wrong when Lewis is involved with it, but then they're also able to then surprise you when he does something right. And that makes those moments even greater. And he really adds to each character. I mean, they kind of build off of him, and they use him to build their stories. Mm. which I really love. But he makes me laugh, and I'm like, God, you're such a dick, but I love watching you on this show.
My second one is, I used to watch the show The League. I liked that show quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, until What's-His-Face
ridiculous.
Became a jerk.
Yeah, until one of the guys became a jerk, but whatever. But I really enjoyed that show, and it was like so ridiculous and absurd, but still reminded me of my friends. But Rafi on The League, Jason Mantzoukas, who a lot of people might know him from How Did This Get Made? He's on that podcast, and he's been a supporting
player. He's on The Good Place now.
He's on The Good Place? Okay. He's become a very popular... He's that guy with a crazy beard. That's Jason Mantzoukas. But in that
show... crazy voice.
Crazy voice, yeah.
Yeah, he is super crazy.
But in that show, in The League, every time I would watch it, and he would just randomly drop it. He was like a hit it and quit it kind of comedian. He'd just run in, drop some crazy comedy bomb, and then just run out. And it was always like the highlight of whatever that episode was about. I didn't care what it was about. He always made that show a little bit better. And that, we're talking about a show that's already out there. Like, these are already people that are just going bonkers, because there's a lot of improv in that show. And he would make it, he would make everything just better and worse at the same time. It was just a fantastic thing to watch. And I remember seeing him pop up in so many episodes and be thinking, wow, here's a guy, like, after he made me laugh and everything else and he did whatever he did, I'm like, this guy is making really interesting choices. He has got to be a very smart guy. But he always came across as kind of like a dipshit in the show. And then you go listen to him and like hear him talk, and he's a very articulated, smart guy who apparently just can't shave his beard. I don't understand, but he is so great in that kind of stuff. And I've followed him since then because he was that entertaining on that show. And I will watch him do anything at this point.
I absolutely love Jason Mantzoukas, and he, as you said, brings life to every scene that he's in, but he's also one of the most beloved comedians in Hollywood from people who have done like the comedy classes. I can't remember what the name of it is, if it's like Second City or whatever it is, but he is absolutely loved. Like, people say that he is one of the most intellectual comedians that has been around. And people will, like, whenever he comes back to this theater school or whatever it is, comedian school, it'll sell out. Like, there's no room for anybody else, like space.
You'd think he'd be more popular, but I mean, in terms of like pop culture, not just cult culture.
Yeah.
He's a very cult popular actor, but he's not a popular actor. You know what I mean?
I think it's because part of what you said, he comes across as an idiot. That's how his characters are. But he's actually so he's so deliberate in everything that he does when you think about it. And when you actually see how he's interacting in these different things. Oh, he's in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, too. Like, he shows up everywhere and he's freaking wild. And I love him. And he knows how to make every scene more enjoyable.
Yeah, I really do love him. And speaking of characters or people or actors who actually make the role, Cameron Britton's portrayal of Ed Kemper in Mindhunters. So Ed Kemper is supposed to be this super large, very scary serial killer who's just actually very mild-mannered. And when we meet Ed Kemper in Mindhunters, especially the way Cameron Britton is portraying him, he's hard to take your eyes off of. Like, every little step, if you've listened to anything about Ed Kemper, he's doing it pretty close to how Ed Kemper behaved, and he is just fascinating to watch. And then you see the same actor in Umbrella Academy playing Hazel, and again, as much as I really enjoyed that show, I think one of my favorite parts of that show was Hazel because of the way Cameron was playing it. So it's, but yes, primarily I love the way he did Ed Kemper on Mindhunter.
That's a good one. I haven't finished that show, but I intend to go back to it. But I did see him, and he was great.
My last one is Mina Okafor, played by Shauna Renee Wilson in The Resident.
I've never seen this, so I have to take your word on this one.
She's one I've talked about before. Same. I know there's some listeners in the Facebook group who do watch The Resident and also agree she is incredible as an actress. She was one of the actresses in Black Panther, but obviously not one of like the top notable ones.
There's like 40 actresses in Black Panther.
Yeah, but she's in there. She is incredibly talented. She knows how to make you feel everything, even though she doesn't express any emotion most of the time as a character. And then the moments where they do have her express emotion, like they did that recently in one of the latest episodes, holy crap, it crushed me. She knows how to make every scene, make your eyes in every scene go to her. everything that happens. I want to know what she's doing. I want to know about her character arc. I want her stories more involved. If it were not for, I love the leads, don't get me wrong. Like, that's the reason I started watching the show, because Emily Van Camp from Revenge,
yeah.
And she is spectacular. And then Matt, I don't know how to say his last name, and I'm not going to try, but he was in Gilmore Girls. The two of them are great together and have tons of chemistry. But when it comes to Mina's character, it really is the actress that, if she were not there, the show would not be as compelling as it is. And she is just a very side character. Like, she's very supporting. She's not, they don't make her primary in any respect.
But she's that good.
Like, she's that good. She's still in every episode, but her stories are obviously put to the wayside compared to the leads and stuff. And when we do get glimpses into her story, I'm like, I would take a spinoff of just her reading a book. I don't care.
Well, maybe this will be her big break then.
She definitely deserves it. She's extremely talented.
Makes me want to check out the show just so I can see like her performance.
Yeah, she's real good.
Yeah, it was interesting when I was putting together the graphic for this episode. Like, the very first thing that came up with was how her character was a BAMF. So,
a BAMF, a badass mofo.
Yes. Huh. Yes.
Now I'm curious.
She's real awesome.
Speaking of BAMFs, my last one is a BAMF. And that's Kim Coates, who played Tig in Sons of Anarchy. I would have quit that stupid-ass show in season 4 if it wasn't for Tig. Because this is a character who every single episode, I just sat there waiting for him to show up, do something weird, say something creepy, act really unstable, and just make basically do the opposite of everything I would expect an actor to do in that specific role, because he's part of a biker gang. Everyone else is full of false machismo and, you know, just everything is about smoking fools and, you know, making out with chicks or whatever. Here's this one guy who is just making weird acting choices left and right. And I found him absolutely fascinating. And he's one of those guys where I've liked him in everything he's done. He's very, very supporting actor material. He's always the bit part player. And you saw The Last Boy Scout. He's the guy, you know, touch me again, I'll kill you. He's the guy that got killed because of that.
He looks crazy.
Yeah, he looks crazy in everything he does. But in Sons of Anarchy, he really made a fully fledged character and really the most compelling character for me in the show. Everybody else is talking about Jax. Everybody else is talking about Clay. Everybody's talking about Gemma. And I'm just over here going, Tig, you can take them all, kill them all today, and I would watch the Tig show. In a heartbeat. With Walton Goggins as a spinoff, but that's a little in joke for friends. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for the Hollywood Outsider Movie Battle Royale. That is where we take 8 films, 2 favorites from each of our hosts, and we determine which one is the ultimate greatest film in the entire whole universe. It is definitely a lot of fun, and it is time to get to it. Let's decide what is the greatest film of a genre. It's time for the Movie Battle Royale. That's right. It's the Stephen King Adaptation Edition. Before we get to the rules, I guess. Welcome from the Blacklist Exposed and several Stephen King-related episodes of Remake This Movie Right, which we just referenced a little bit ago. Troy Heinrichs.
I do have the shine. Thanks for having me here.
A lot of people don't know what that means, man.
That was cheesy.
They will by the time this is over.
Ah! All right. Well, this is our Stephen King Movie Battle Royale. As I said, if you've never heard our battles before, we select our top 8 candidates and vote away to decide what is the greatest film of its kind in hostery. That's too cheesy.
That was way too far.
Ho-history. This time, we actually tried to do things a little different. So instead of us picking, usually what we do is we each pick 2, and then we kind of battle it out for the top one, and then just ask the listeners what they thought. We did it different this time. This time, we let listeners and those in our Facebook group vote on the 8 finalists. So while we're deciding the ultimate winner, you guys decided who the final 8 were going to be. Mostly so you can't bitch at us that one of them didn't make it to the final 8. Boom.
Way to sound hostile to our fans or our listeners. Or I mean, I guess being calling them fans is too presumptuous.
I just want to say thank you to the fans for not voting for Dreamcatcher.
Did you really think this was going to be an issue?
John sounded offended.
Jumped on Dreamcatcher.
Did the remake. I'm not talking about it again.
Yeah, it's a bad movie. awful. Okay, one other stipulation. This is important before we actually vote. The quality of the adaptation can be a factor in your vote, but ultimately we are voting on what are the best movies, not necessarily what is the absolute closest to King's original work, because I'm sure that's exactly the kind of comments we're going to get no matter which way we vote. I don't care what you vote for. Somebody's going to say this other movie was much closer to the book. And honestly, if we did that, we'd have to bounce a few of these out already. The Shining, you know, there's some movies that just aren't that faithful, but are still great movies based on Stephen King's work. So that's what we're basing on. Best movie. Clear?
Crystal.
Clear.
I guess.
Well, at least you're convinced. All right, with that, let's get into this. We do Ho North and Ho South. Each person presents their two movies and why they should be voted for, each one of them. Then they collect the vote, and then we'll move on to the semifinals. Amanda, you go first. Ho North, go ahead.
My first one is Pet Sematary from 1989.
I'll bite, John. What's the bottom of the truth?
Well, sometimes dead is better. The person you put up there ain't the person that comes back. It may look like that person, but it ain't that person. Because whatever lives in the ground beyond the Pet Sematary ain't human at all.
After tragedy strikes, a grieving father discovers an ancient burial ground behind his home with the power to raise the dead. Creepy cats, creepy children, children who get hit by trains and their shoes go flying. This is a pretty good movie. People come back from the dead. Animals come back from the dead. It's awesome. Some of the interesting facts that I found about this is Stephen King required the movie to be filmed in Maine and his screenplay to be followed rigorously. As has been mentioned earlier in the show, he's the one who wrote the script. So it's obviously something that from the novelist himself had a lot of deciding factor and power into what went into this movie. But it's still a great movie even without that. The original cut of the film delivered to Paramount's executives was judged to be too long, so excess footage had to be removed. They also decided that the closing scene was too tame, and at their request, it was reshot to be more graphic. I thought this was a great point to bring up, because who doesn't want more graphic content in their Stephen King film, right?
Whatever makes it a better movie.
It made it better.
Okay.
Also, the budget was, not that this really helps it too much, $11.5 million, and it grossed $57 million. And Bruce Campbell was set to be the first choice for the role of Lewis Creed.
I knew that.
Sad tears that he wasn't. But the casting still worked really great.
I think Dale Midkiff is great.
This is a good movie. And obviously, lots of people voted for it, so It's a great pick.
What's your second one?
My second is Stand By Me from 1986.
Could he have gotten all the way from Chamberlain to Harlem? That's really far.
Sure. He must have started walking on the train tracks and just followed them the whole way.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And then after dark, train must have come along and I'll smacko.
Yeah. Hey, you guys. I bet you anything that if we find him, we'll get our pictures in the paper.
Yeah, we can even be on TV.
Sure.
We'll be heroes.
After the death of a friend, a writer recounts a boyhood journey to find the body of a missing boy. It has Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Jerry O'Connell, Corey Feldman, and Kiefer Sutherland, who's amazing. After director Rob Reiner screened the movie for Stephen King.
Are you saying Will Wheaton is not amazing?
No, I am. They're all amazing.
Okay.
They're all amazing.
Because he's Crusher. You know what I'm saying?
They're all amazing.
Just letting you know. Okay.
Continue. Even the ones who have passed, RIP. After director Rob Reiner screened the movie for Stephen King.
Hang on. That actually is RIP because it's River Phoenix. So I'm just having a whole brain thing going on right now.
What is going on right
Sorry,
now?
Sorry, I interrupted you twice. Go ahead.
You have like a severe ADD tonight.
You said RIP and I'm like, wait, does she mean his initials? Holy shit.
Is his middle name an I?
It is now.
Oh my gosh. Well, anyway, when the movie was screened for Stephen King, he noticed that director had noticed that King was visibly shaking and wasn't speaking. He left the room and upon his return told Reiner that the movie was the best adaptation of his work he had ever seen, which is spectacular. To have he didn't write the script on this one, but he had somebody who, the director, that he really believed in and, I mean, physically made him shake from watching this movie. There's also some really interesting parts that I found out about this. So the movie is amazing and it's also a classic. And I even watched part of this in school. I don't think I should have watched part of this in school.
Really? Like in class?
Like in middle school.
What are they teaching? This is how you find a body, kids.
I think it was just about read. It was like an English class. Oh, so it was like, okay. But we didn't read the book. So I don't.
Well, it's a very short story. So
yeah, I have it. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it when I first bought it, that that's what it was from. The body was from this. Anyway, in the campfire scene in which Chris breaks down, Rob Reiner was sure River Phoenix could do better. He asked him to think of a time in his own life when an adult had let him down and use it in the scene, which Phoenix did. Upset and crying, he had to be comforted by the director afterwards. The result of Phoenix's exercise is a scene that ended in the final cut, which is pretty spectacular too, and also really traumatic to make a child that frantic. But also, the performances were so captivating because they were real, raw emotions that were brought to life. River Phoenix did lose his virginity thanks to this movie.
With Corey Feldman?
No. Oh. But Corey Feldman did have his first experience drinking alcohol, kissing a girl off screen, and smoking pot for the first time. So this movie really set some set their lives on a new stage. They also got some pot cookies. But
what does any of that have to do with the movie?
It doesn't, but they're fun facts. Okay, so here's the last thing. This is how much people believed in this movie before it even began filming. Coca-Cola bought Embassy Pictures, the film's original production company, and announced it wasn't going to fund the film just 2 days before production was to begin. Norman Lear, who had worked with Rob for years on All in the Family, mm-hmm. was one of the three owners of Embassy prior to its sale. He believed in the project so much that he agreed to personally foot the film's $8 million budget. I'm not throwing anybody $8 million, but if I do, like this man, it's probably for a good reason. This film has spectacular child actors, a great story, and it's one that lives on. So those are my two picks.
Okay.
Troy, our guest, what is your choice between Pet Sematary and Stand By Me?
Well, Pet Sematary itself is creepy as all get out because I hate animals to begin with, and I hate animals that come back to life even more. But just the entire concept happens. Of the fact that he moved away from Chicago to come to this place, this creepy ass in the woods where trucks hit everything that come down the highway. I mean, you get property taxes have to be even higher there because of all the accidents, plus the creepy woods in the back. Move back to Chicago, dude. But Stand By Me is by far the better movie. It's the best Stephen King adaptation. It's almost word for word to the body. I have to add in a little bit just for screen presence. Plus, it has an amazing remake that was done. So I will vote for Stand By Me in a heartbeat.
Good pick. Johnny, what's yours?
I'm going to have to go with Stand By Me for all the reasons that Troy just said, with the exception of the adaptation, because I don't know any of that because I don't read. But on the flip side of that, Pet Sematary was a movie that I just never resonated with me. It never really did anything for me. And least of all, it didn't scare me because, like, you know, not scary.
Oh, well then, not good enough for you. Mm-hmm. Aaron, is Pet Sematary good enough for you?
It's very close, actually. Like, legitimately, I've had to debate this all day. Because I love both movies. I don't care what anybody says. That Pet Sematary won. Dale Midkiff is great in that movie. He gets zero appreciation, and I make fun of him for the no scene.
It's so great.
But it's really... He does everything Jason Clarke doesn't do. He convinces me why a guy would want to do the things he does in that movie and dig up and bury his wife and hope she comes back and, you know, his kid and everything. All that stuff he does, I get why he does it in that movie. So, but Stand By Me is really, it's not perfection to me. It's not a perfect movie, but it's a great film. It is a great film. And I have to pick that one. It doesn't matter what I'm at because it's already... Stand By Me.
Well, anyway, yeah, but we still like to know.
It would still be Stand By Me.
Wow.
It's not my favorite Stephen King adaptation, as you're about to find out, but it's definitely, it's up there.
Okay. Well, Stand By Me moves on.
All right. That's my turn. My first movie is The Mist.
Going out now, Mrs. Carmody. Please stand aside.
You can't go out. I won't allow it.
Won't allow it?
It's against God's will. Don't you know that by now? Haven't I proven myself again and again and again? Haven't I shown that I am his vessel? What's the matter with you? Don't you believe in God?
No one's interfered with you. All we're asking for is the same privilege.
The plot revolves around members of the small town of Bridgeton, Maine, who, after a severe thunderstorm, causes the power to go out the night before, they meet in the supermarket to pick up supplies. While they struggle to survive, an unnatural mist envelops the town and conceals vicious Lovecraftian monsters as extreme tensions rise among the survivors, all probably because of those damn scientists on Arrowhead Mountain. And be wary of Mrs. Carmody, because she's nuts. The Mist is my all-time favorite Stephen King story, by a mile. I mean, it's a short novella, but it's my favorite one, by a mile. Favorite book is Desperation. That's a whole other story. So it's no surprise that I took this one, but let me tell you what's so great about the movie. Written and directed by Frank Darabont, who helmed three films in our top eight. Three in this top eight are directed by Frank Darabont. So I really feel it's going to be a Darabont battle royale at some point. The Mist stars Thomas Jane as a father determined to protect his son, Andre Brower as his lawyer neighbor Brent, Lori Holden as Amanda Dumfries, and Marcia Gay Harden as a religious nut, Mrs. Carmody. The novella doesn't have an ending, okay? It actually concludes with several of them continuing into the mist. But Darabont wanted to try something different, so he gave this film one of the most controversial endings in film history, I would argue. I won't spoil what it is, but it's bold, it's grim, and it's horrific. And of course, Stephen King approved, which I think is saying a lot. Now, there are some fun facts as well. The monsters are terrifying more so in the black and white version that Darabont preferred. You can find it on a home video. But the movie was scarier because it showed how quickly people will turn on each other when terrified, how they'll come to believe in things they previously didn't, like God, and how quickly humanity can spiral out of control. But Frank Darabont agreed to make the film with Dimension only under the condition that no matter what, they would not change the scripted ending. They agreed, but Darabont had to forfeit his director's salary.
What?
That's how committed he was to getting this done. Because they had to cut the budget in half because the ending is very dire. It's not a Hollywood ending in any way, shape, or form. During an action scene in the film, a man runs into a wire-rotating bookshelf in the grocery store, and if you look carefully, you can clearly see that all of the books on the shelf are written by Stephen King. Aha. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And also, this is kind of an interesting fact. Jeffrey DeMunn, Melissa McBride, Lori Holden, Juan Gabriel Pereira, Sherry Dvorak, Sam Witwer, and Tiffany Morgan are all in The Walking Dead, adapted to TV by Frank Darabont, and he also wanted Thomas Jane, who plays the star here, for Rick Grimes, but it just didn't work out. There's a connection.
Did not know that one.
Yeah. The Mist made $57 million worldwide. It has a 72% approval rating based on 142 reviews. Bloody Disgusting ranked the film number 4 on their list of the top 20 horror films of that decade. There was a 10-episode series adaptation on Spike TV, but it only lasted one season because you don't need a TV show when you got this damn movie. That's my first pick, The Mist. Number 2 is Misery.
Well, it's brilliantly written, but then everything you write is brilliant.
Pretty rough stuff.
The swearing, Paul. There, I said it.
The profanity bothers you.
It has no nobility.
These are slum kids. I was a slum kid. Everybody talks like that.
They do not? What do you think I say when I go to the feed store in town? Oh, now, Wally, give me a bag of that effing pig feed and 10 pounds of that bitchly cow corn. And in the bank, do I tell Mrs. Bollinger, oh, here's one big bastard of a check. Give me some of your Christing money. There, look there. See what you made me do. Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
James Caan stars as famous author of Victorian romance novels, Paul Sheldon, and his books feature a character named Misery Chastain. I almost said mystery, but it's I'm stuck on mist. Misery Chastain. While traveling from Colorado back home to New York, Sheldon is caught in a blizzard and his car crashes, leaving him unconscious. He wakes up in the home of Nurse Annie Wilkes, played with Optimal Crazy by Kathy Bates, who won an Oscar and a Golden Globe for this role. Annie reads his latest book and becomes enraged that he kills the main character. Therefore, she kidnaps him and forces him to write a new book, at one point even smashing his ankles to ensure he can't leave. In the original, and anybody who's ever dated crazy knows this is always a possibility. In the original novel, yep. Annie Wilkes severs one of Paul Sheldon's feet with an axe. Goldman loved the scene and argued for it to be included, but Rob Reiner, the director, insisted that it be changed so that she only breaks his ankles. Goldman subsequently wrote this was the correct decision as amputation would have been too severe.
Rob Reiner also has a couple movies here, because he has Stand By Me as well, studied Alfred Hitchcock movies to figure out how to shoot a thriller, watching every Hitchcock film. Reiner had Hitchcock on the brain so much that James Caan overheard Reiner chastising himself on set one day, asking himself, "Who do you think you are? Alfred Hitchcock?" The answer is no, because he's the greatest director of all time. After refusing to speak about his motivations for writing Misery for two decades, Stephen King finally came out and stated that it is indeed about his battle with substance abuse. Kathy Bates' character is a representation of his dependency on drugs and what it did to his body, making him feel alone and separated from everything, while hobbling any attempts he made at escape.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. I did not know that.
A lot deeper than people thought.
He did drugs?
Oh, yeah.
Whoa.
That's a whole other podcast. On Rotten Tomatoes, the film has an 89% rating based on 66 reviews. It made $61 million domestic. Annie Wilkes was ranked number 17 on AFI's 100 Years, one of villains and heroes. So the top 100 heroes and villains list. Not too shabby. Now, those are my two picks, Misery and The Mist. Amanda, you keep, you're across from me and you keep shaking your head.
I hate The Mist. Like, I thought it was a terrible movie. It's not. I respect the ending and I like that choice, but everything else about the movie, aside from Andre Brouwer, I didn't realize he was, because I just recently watched this. This is one of the few movies that I hadn't seen that I needed to fix. And wow, I really wanted that movie to end. I was ready to go out and let the creatures take me. So I didn't like it at all.
As you can hear, we don't care about your opinion, and we want you to understand that The Mist is a great movie, and we're sorry you can't understand the greatness.
Okay, wrong.
Is it above you? Is it just like you don't get it?
No, I get it. I get it fine.
I don't think you get it.
Also, just in case anybody's wondering.
It's a mist, and there are monsters in it.
In The Mist. Really, I love the concept.
But really, the monsters are in the grocery store.
I love the concept. Did not like the execution.
Did you like Stranger Things?
I haven't finished it. I'm still in season one.
I guess it explains a lot then.
No, also, I love the concept.
What was that noise that John just made? Because I really wanted
I'm so exasperated by the fact that she hasn't finished even being caught up with Stranger. Okay, she's got to go.
We have talked about this, Johnny.
You've had plenty of time to catch up since we talked about it last.
Oh,
anyway,
my gosh.
Go ahead.
Before we go on the cruise, I will watch it.
What's your vote?
Misery. Because Kathy Bates is spectacular, creeps me out, and the movie is well executed, unlike The Mist. And also, if you try to sue your neighbor for a tree falling on your house, your insurance company is going to tell you that is your responsibility because it fell on your house. Okay. Nobody else's insurance is going to cover that, so don't have a 50-minute conversation about it. Let it go.
You get hung up on some weird stuff. Troy, Troy, what is your pick?
Well, let me tell you, Misery is a movie, and Kathy Bates is amazing, just absolutely amazing in it. She just knocks it out of the park. But if Kathy Bates is not in that movie is boring as all get out.
Well, it's a good thing she's
in this movie. It is a giant snooze fest, and no one cares about stupid authors laying in a bed, because when you have giant killer bees, spiders exploding other spiders, tentacle monsters, pterodactyls cracking in windows, all kinds of other amazing fun things going on, and then you add Frank's ending to the movie, The Mist is the best movie from a Stephen King adaptation that actually changes it enough that actually makes it 100 times better. So The Mist, all the way.
I bet you that screenplay probably looks great on paper.
You already had your say, all right? You shush. John, what's your vote? You decide.
Wow, this is really tough. No, it's not. The Mist.
Is that just in spite of Stranger Things?
Yes and no. The Mist is a wonderful, fun, scary, and intense movie. And the whole idea of these monsters that can, like, you don't really see very well and they just jump out. Yeah, all those things make it just a better movie. Then you got Thomas Jane, who... if it's got Thomas Jane in it, I'm going to usually try to side with him because I don't know what happened to his career. He should have had one. Aww. I don't know where it went. So anytime we have a chance to actually vote for Thomas Jane, I'll do it. And finally, Troy said it the best when it came to Misery. Without Kathy Bates, that movie does not work.
Well, it's a good thing she's in the movie that we're discussing.
Well, it doesn't matter because the mist moves on. Now we go to Ho South. John, you get them first. What are your two picks?
My very first movie I'm going to present to you, my favorite panel in the whole wide world, is The Green Mile.
I'm tired, boss. Tired of being on the road, lonely as a sparrow in the rain. I'm tired of never having me a buddy to be with, to tell me where we's going to, coming from, or why. Mostly I'm tired of people being ugly to each other. I'm tired of all the pain I feel and hear in the world every day. There's too much of it. It's like pieces of glass in my head all the time. Can you understand?
Yes, John.
Released in the ripe old time of 1999, a scrappy writer-director looking to make a name for himself tackled this mountain of a movie. That scrappy writer-director is Frank Darabont. We have mentioned him before, but here he is again. Is this his first time tackling this sort of subject matter? No, it's actually his second time dealing with both Stephen King and a prison, because we're going to talk about that other one later. This time, there's magic, though, and arguably, because of that magic, it makes this movie better. It has a lot more heart. It has a lot more going for it. The film stars Tom Hanks, James Cromwell, Bonnie Hunt, and David Morse. All these people are titans in their own right. However, we're introduced to the lighter side of Michael Clark Duncan, who just showed us how much heart he can show and bring in a movie, and with this wonderful character that he played of Mr. Coffee. It also proved that even way back when, someone as unknown as Sam Rockwell can still make anything that he does a little better just by being him. The story of The Green Mile is one of hope. It touches the heart and it oozes magic. And that's why it's my first choice. Okay. My second choice is 2017's It.
Hiya, Georgie. What a nice boat. Do you want it back?
Yes, please.
You look like a nice boy. I bet you have a lot of friends.
Three, but my brother's my best S.
Where is he?
In bed, sick.
I bet I could cheer him up. I'll give him a balloon. Do you want a balloon too, Georgie?
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers.
Oh, well, I'm Pennywise the Dancing Clown. Pennywise? Yes, meet Georgie. Georgie, meet Pennywise. Now we aren't strangers, are we?
With even less credits to his name than Frank Darabont had, Andy Muschietti, what a great name for a director, was tasked with not only working with a Stephen King novel, but also bringing up something that is long loved and has already been done once before in a movie form, or actually a miniseries form, back in the 1990s. Actually helped draw a lot of ire from that wicked beast, the internet, that we all know about. It starred Tim Curry as the memorable Pennywise, and it was something that was just fascinating to watch and terrifying. So how does this movie fill those big ass clown shoes? Well, they found a way to take a story that we all know and love and still found a way to scare us. Complaints of the recasting did not actually hold any water because the cast was fascinating, fun, and scary to watch. This creative team managed to take a story that we all knew and found a new way to scare us. And it was executed in a way that taught people that we can actually remake these stories. And so with that, I'm going to go to Aaron. Which one of these two movies do you like the best?
Green Mile and It. It, I thought, was a great adaptation of the book. It was probably one of the best horror adaptations of any Stephen King novel. That said, The Green Mile is a movie I've watched over and over and over again, and it moves me every time I watch it. Sam Rockwell is fantastic. Michael Clark Duncan is fantastic. It feels like it almost feels like I'm there in that movie. It feels like I'm going through the same experiences that they are, and every time I put it on, I can't turn it off. Whereas It, I like it, but I just don't have the emotional connection. So I'm going to go with The Green Mile. Green Mile hits me a lot more than It does.
Okay. Troy?
That's a tough call for me because the Green Mile is everything that Aaron said that it is. The only problem is that it is like a fundamental Stephen King property, whether it's the book, whether it's the TV miniseries, whether it's this movie. And yes, technically it's only half of the movie because there's part two still coming out this year, but it had gotten so many things right in this, I guess you call it a remake of the miniseries, but it's its own movie in its own regard. I mean, it includes Maturin inside of there with a giant Lego turtle. So it pulls on some of the amazing things from the book. It has the orgy scene, if you will, without the orgy, but they get the concept of the orgy scene where they're all banding together to have their powers. Mm-hmm. And the way they leave the circle at the end of the movie is actually very significant when you tie it back to the book in particular. So where I think The Green Mile is a great movie and I enjoy watching it and I get the feels and everything from it and I love The Little Mouse, I think from a Stephen King perspective, I think it is a better movie because I enjoyed it. I saw a giant fat man throw a bucket of popcorn up in the air during the clown scene in the house. So when the popcorn bucket obstructs your view, I think you're in the right place. So I would have to go with it, unfortunately, over The Green Mile.
Well, it's no unfortunate. These are both great picks. I mean,
so I get to be the tiebreaker.
You get to decide.
Yay.
Yeah, because making decisions is what you love to do.
Right? She's so good at it.
I'm excellent.
Did she pick two?
Yeah, right? Can I move them both to the next round? So I do love this version of it. I agree that it was creepy. The dialogue was amazing. It was super funny. But Green Mile is something that was so unique, and I like that it plays on stereotypes and social commentary, but also has a lot of heart in it. And we all know I'm a sap for some heart in my movies. I like to cry. Green Mile is something that stands up time after time that I want to go back and revisit. It is something that I don't mind revisiting, but I don't need to revisit. I'm going with Green Mile.
All right. Green Mile moves on. Troy, you get the last two to present before we move into the semifinals. So what are your two Stephen King adaptations?
Well, I am going to go with the one that's kind of started it all, first and foremost, and that is The Shining.
I think maybe he should be taken to a doctor.
You think maybe he should be taken to a doctor? When do you think maybe he should be taken to a doctor?
As soon as possible. As soon as possible. Jack.
You believe his health might be at stake?
Yes.
You are concerned about him.
Yes.
And are you concerned about me?
Of course I am.
Of course you are.
Now, this movie is a series of mysteries that are all connected to each other. It's not a perfect movie. It's an amazing mystery. We'll put it that way. It's a great Stanley Kubrick film. It is not a Stephen King film. So just keep that for what it's worth.
You're like anti-selling us.
but no, it's a really great, amazing mystery. And I would have to argue with Aaron that The Mist is a good horror, but it's not really a horror. It's like an action. The Mist is an action flick with some... what do you want to call it? Cerebral context to it. I think that The Shining is a pure horror film. It blurs the line between sanity and insanity. And until the last act, there's actually two explanations of going on the entire time. Either he's going insane from cabin fever, or he's completely having a mental breakdown when he goes and attacks his family. And we don't even know what the hell's going on until you get to the very last part of it. You know, is he being corrupted by these evil spirits that inhabit the hotel? And when the truth is finally revealed in the last part of the movie, it's not even explained why the ghosts are doing what they're doing in the first place. Very little is answered, and you're left completely wondering why this all happened in the first place. And I think that's an amazing thing for the movie. I mean, it sticks, and it makes you wonder, and it makes you walk away and go, huh. And then you kind of watch it a couple more times. Plus, there's tons of the shout-outs and hidden messages from King properties in the movie. Fans have actually mapped out the entire maze and the layout of the mansion. They're basically trying to illustrate all of the theories that are out there. And the opening scene from the movie even features a certain car familiar to King fans. And, of course, you can't forget Room 237, because 237 is a very prominent number in Stephen King lore. Now, What I thought was fascinating, though, is that in tribute to the film, the makers of Toy Story actually made the carpet in Sid's house. If you look at the carpet, it's the same carpet from the carpet hallway scene in The Shining. And in fact, Lee Unkrich, who was part of Toy Story 3, the director, he actually runs a website dedicated to The Shining film.
Oh, wow. That's a fun fact.
I like this carpet thing. That's a fun fact.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Stephen King said that the title was inspired actually by John Lennon's Instant Karma, which actually features the line in the song, "We All Shine On," which is where the shining comes from. And Danny is one of the kids known to have the shine, this special psychic power to kind of see the other universes inside of the Dark Tower, kind of levels and mechanisms inside of the King universe. And Jake actually has the shine in the Dark Tower series, and they talk about Danny actually in the Dark Tower itself. So there's a lot of connections there. The heat that they actually generate from the lighting used to recreate the window sunlight inside of the hotel, the lounge set actually caught on fire and burnt down. And I pulled this one just for Aaron because when that got rebuilt as part of the L Street Studios, that has actually got a higher ceiling now and was used as the snake-filled tomb in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Get out of here. That's cool. Yeah,
totally.
Something good came from that movie.
Oh, boy.
The Shining is also in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most retakes of a single scene, with 127 takes for the scene with Shelley Duvall.
Well, and do you want to narrow that down? I mean, she's in the movie a lot. Do you know which scene?
I can't remember which one it was in particular, but it technically it took a lot to get that scene correct.
Okay.
With 127 takes. And the MPAA did not allow blood to be shown in any trailers that would be seen by all ages. And Kubrick persuaded them that the blood was rusty water and got the trailer passed.
Oh, wow.
That's funny.
Shining sits at 52 on IMDb's top 250 with a Metascore of 63. That is The Shining. My second movie is The Shawshank Redemption.
Emile Dufresne.
Wife-killing banker. Why'd you do it?
I didn't, since you ask.
You gonna fit right in. Everybody in here is innocent. Didn't you know that? Heywood, what you in here for?
Didn't do it.
Rumor has it you're a real cold fish. You think your shit smells sweeter than most. Is that right?
What do you think?
I'll tell you the truth. I had made up my mind.
I understand you're a man that knows how to get things.
I'm known to locate certain things from time to time.
I wonder if you might get me a rock hammer.
A what?
A rock hammer.
Now, Shawshank is interesting because there is no way in hell this will lose to The Green Mile because stupid freaking Tom Hanks stole the Oscar from The Shawshank Redemption in the 1995 ceremony for films released in 1994. It was highway robbery that The Shawshank Redemption lost. I can understand why, because it was considered a box office flop, only bringing in $18 million for the $25 million budget. However, because of the Oscar nomination, that's when The Shawshank Redemption really began to shine, and then was picked up by Turner Classic and the Turner Corporation, and has literally aired on cable almost every day since then on TNT, TBS, or the like. The Shawshank actually takes place over a 30-year period in the books, and it's only about 10 to 15 in the movie, where Andy Dufresne is a banker, accountant, and he basically gets locked up in jail for a crime he didn't commit. He got framed for the crime, and he ends up meeting this guy named Red inside of Shawshank, where he becomes best friends with him, played by Morgan Freeman. Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman are just amazing in this movie. The things you learn in this movie are fantastic. The feels you get in this movie are fantastic. Everything about this movie is awesome. To this day, when The Marriage of Figaro plays anywhere, I cry because of that scene when they play the opera lady singing inside the yard, because of Shawshank Redemption. In fact, the Shawshank Redemption is so prominent that people that are living in corporate America at their jobs for more than 10 years actually refer to their term at their companies as being Brooks'd, because they have been institutionalized in their jobs because they can't work anywhere else because they don't know how to do anything else. That's how iconic this has been. Waze, the app, actually had Morgan Freeman do voices for the Waze app. And when you had to turn left or turn right, it actually said, "Get busy turning or get busy dying."
That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Morgan Freeman's son also posed for the mugshot that you see when they stamp his papers to be paroled. Morgan Freeman himself, actually, when he pitches the baseball, when he meets Andy for the first time in the movie, Morgan Freeman actually threw that baseball for 9 hours straight.
No.
Literally dislocated his arm and had to wear a sling the next day.
Wow.
The sewer sludge inside of that 500 yards of bile and whatever else he had to crawl through, the length of 5 football fields, that was actually chocolate, if you can believe it. Chocolate, syrup, sawdust, and water. And even to this day, the pipes still smell like chocolate and cocoa today.
Oh, so that's cool. So if you're escaping, it smells delicious.
Exactly. We also have the number 237 showing up again here in the movie. For instance, it's the number on Red's cell specifically. And the digits are also Andy's prison ID number. And the number, of course, continues on, as I mentioned, in other places, including the room in The Shining. And the sound of the warden actually shooting himself is the same sound effect that they used for the man stamping approved on Red's parole paper.
Oh, wow. Cool facts, man. You're finding some cool, fun facts.
The other big thing that you want to know about this is that the TV show Castle Rock on Hulu, which aired last summer, actually was all based on a lot of the things that happened in Shawshank Redemption, to the fact that they actually had a scene where you got to see the warden's office, and the bullet hole is in exactly the same place in Castle Rock as it was from where the warden shot himself from the movie. So that was a cool little tie-in. The big thing, though, is that in 2015, the United States Library of Congress selected the film for preservation in the National Film Registry, finding it culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. And FYI, it is number one on the IMDb Top 250, beating out The Godfather in 2008 and holding that spot ever since. The other movies in that top five are, of course, The Dark Knight, Godfather 2, and Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Wow.
Wait, Return of the King is the top Lord of the Rings one?
Return of the King is the top in the top five of the top 250 on IMDb.
Wow.
But most importantly, be excited that it was Raquel Welch in the movie, because in the book, the poster is actually Linda Ronstadt.
Yeah, that's a good change.
That would have been bad.
Yeah.
So regardless of what Peter Griffin from Pam the Guy says about the Raquel Welch poster, because I can completely debunk how you can tie that down and make it taut enough in order for the rock to go through.
No, you can't. It's a good theory. It's a good point.
Loops. It's tape loops. And you just use your fingers and pull. So mm-hmm. It's awesome.
I don't think that's how it works.
Anyways, we're going to go to Johnny first to vote on whether or not Shawshank can clearly beat out The Shining.
Was there another movie that you mentioned besides Shawshank?
I don't think so. I mean, he said The Shining, but it didn't feel like he said The Shining. More like, I got words, Shawshank.
Right. All right. So it's not going to be very hard to discern where my vote's going to go. So let me just say, a few years ago, I finally sat down and watched The Shining, because I had heard from so many people who love movies how amazing and fantastic that movie was. It's not. It's not at all. I didn't enjoy it. It wasn't a good time for me, and I want my money back. Somehow I own it too, so that's disappointing now. So that's why I'm going to say Shawshank.
Amanda, let's go to you.
This may surprise you. Fun fact, The Shining is actually taught in almost every single one of my film classes that I've taken, from both my associates and my bachelor's. Mm-hmm. So obviously, film professors and the dean of film who creates this catalog of films that they feel we need to see, some of the best movies, a lot of which are Hitchcock. And The Shining. Shawshank was never in the lists. Sad times. That's where my vote goes, is Shawshank. Because, like, The Shining is good from a film.
Well, that took a turn.
Right?
Well, I was confused for a minute. I was like, holding on.
I kind of wanted you guys to think that I was going with The Shining for a second.
Oh, well, nice job.
I do like the movie. I don't hate it like you guys do. There's a lot of good potential in it. But the thing that bothers me the most about it is how much Stephen King did not like that adaptation.
It's one of the few movies of his that he actively admits he does not like.
Adamantly said that there was some parts that were creepy, but even down to Nicholson, that is not the person who is supposed to play the character, because you were supposed to wonder about his sanity and his
Yeah, there's no
mania.
Debate. There's zero debate.
His grin is just something else. But I mean, I still like the movie for what it is. But as a Stephen King movie, I mean, that loses points there. And Shawshank is one of the best movies ever made.
All right. Well, I guess that leaves me. I hate The Shining.
You hate it?
I mean, those professors are dicks. I don't like them at all. And I don't think they should be teaching film history. It's one of those movies where everybody loves to argue with me and tell me how wrong I am. But let me tell you, I've watched it 4 times in my lifetime. 3 of them are because I wanted to reevaluate if I had changed my opinion over time. Because the first time I saw it, I was a kid. Then I saw it again in my 20s and 30s. And, you know, I'm obviously 31. Here's what I've come to surmise. I can't understand what people like about it. Yes, I agree 100% with Stephen King. It is not at all connected to his book. It's very different from his book. If you read his book, it's much more about alcoholism and addiction and losing oneself amongst that. This is more about man goes crazy at cabin. That's really what this movie is.
Right.
And the reason why I don't like it is probably the same reason everybody else loves it. I think Jack Nicholson sucks here. And sucks isn't a great... he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. I love Jack. He's one of my favorite actors of all time. Camp fever. The whole movie. Everybody else feels like they're in a scary-ass horror movie, terrified of everything. And he looks like he is just cheesing out and having the campiest time ever. There's not the Here's Johnny moment, I laugh out loud every time I've ever seen it because there's nothing scary about that. It's just ridiculous. It's him being campy and it doesn't fit the movie. So I can't stand that movie. Shawshank, great movie. It's an easy vote for me. Like I didn't even weigh it.
And his name's not even Johnny in the movie.
No.
It's dumb.
It's just a, hey, look at this connection to Johnny Carson. Ha ha. Yeah, that's funny.
It's a great film. It's a horrible movie.
No, I think it's a bad film. I don't like The Shining at all. I just don't like it as a movie. Everybody always thinks it's just because of the adaptation point of it. It's not. I don't like it as a movie. Jack Nicholson, I feel like, is way too campy for that movie. And most people just hate on me left and right for it. But that is my opinion, and I'm going to stick to it.
Is there anything else in the movie that you don't like? You've mentioned Jack Nicholson and how it was adapted.
I am not a Kubrick fan. I feel like he drags things out and stretches them way too far. That happens in this movie. It's really more about Jack Nicholson's performance, though. That's my biggest problem with that movie. It just doesn't fit everything else that happens. There you go.
All right.
Okay.
Well, I mean, Shawshank was going on anyway.
It's true. So now we come to the semifinals. You don't have to give such detailed answers, but you can give a vote if you want, and we'll use the listener picks if we have to settle any ties. So let's go to Amanda. First, you have Stand By Me versus The Mist.
Stand By Me.
Oh. Okay. That was easy. Now we go to John. John might be a little bit harder here, huh?
Well, both of these movies are great and fantastic, and they have their places in the annals of the canon of which we are discussing here. The Mist.
Okay, now it's up to Troy. Troy, you're going between Stand By Me and The Mist.
Man, that's tough. That is super tough.
Well, you get a vote, too.
I know.
Oh, well, you said Troy gets to decide.
Oh, that's right. You don't get to decide, but you get a vote. You could decide. No, actually, no, you could
decide.
You couldn't, actually.
It's 1-1 so far.
Yeah.
I can't count, man.
Aaron, I can't pick between those two. That's tough.
Well, you're going
to have to at some point. You have to, Amanda. You have to pick. Okay.
So the ending makes The Mist, right? If it wasn't for the ending, The Mist is not that great of a movie. Stand By Me is a good movie. You grow up on it. Everybody watches it. The puking scene is awesome. The leeches scene is awesome.
The leeches were real.
The leeches were real. Yeah. So, gosh. But the ending is so good in The Mist.
But not the whole movie.
I disagree.
I gotta go to The Mist.
What?
What do I do?
Well, it's still not gonna win number one.
What do I do? The Mist versus... I can decide this, and I will. The Mist. I like The Mist so much more than Stand By Me. Oh, we've got our first surprise. Now, let's go to the South and see what we got. The Mist moves on to the finals.
Better movies.
We have
it's the cage fight.
Green Mile versus Shawshank Redemption. Let's start with John this time. What do you got?
This is a really tough call. It honestly is a tough call, but I'm gonna do what I don't do all that often, and I'm gonna vote for my movie just because it has magic, which is The Green Mile.
All right, Troy.
Well, Frank did both movies, and Frank wouldn't have been able to do the second movie without doing the first movie first. And the fact that it's like number one by everybody's regard in the world, pretty much. Shawshank has to go ahead to The Green Mile because it's not losing to freaking Tom Hanks again.
Yeah, I don't care what IMDb says. Amanda?
Shawshank!
Ooh. Well, I'm going with Green Mile.
Well, what are the listeners going
we
with?
We have a tie. Yes, we do. And I'm with John, it has nothing to do with it being your movie. I just think The Green Mile is a better movie than Shawshank Redemption.
You're high.
Mm-hmm. No, I get so much emotion from Green Mile, man.
I get so much emotion from Shawshank. The N, the letter, the island, come on.
None of that hits me as hard as, I'm just so tired of this world, boss. I'm just tired.
Yeah.
People being mean to each other, I'm just tired. I'm going to watch The Green Mile. This is done. All right. So now we move on to the listeners, because we have to decide for this one, because we have a tie. We have Green Mile versus Shawshank. The listeners have, well, it's not close. The Shawshank Redemption is beating The Green Mile. Well, actually, it is kind of close. It's number, yeah. So Shawshank moves on.
Yeah, yeah.
So now we have, honestly, to me, it's an easier one. The Mist versus Shawshank Redemption. And I think, Troy, you get to go first this time.
I think at this point, do we have to go based on like closest adaptation to the works, or just straight on the movie?
It doesn't change anything. It is the best movie.
How we've been voting all along.
Yeah, it's how we've been voting all along. So whatever you, it's your vote. Whatever you think is the best Stephen King movie, go. Of those two, The Mist versus Shawshank.
And that's two Franks again.
Mm-hmm, Frank, I called it early.
It's same logic applies. He doesn't get to do the others unless he gets Shawshank first. So Shawshank gets my vote.
It's a weird way to vote, but okay.
Even though the ending is really good.
I'm going to go next because I've been going last, I think. So The Mist by a mile, actually. I enjoy The Mist so much more.
That's a close vote. That's not easy, even though you think it is. It's not easy.
I enjoy the entire movie, not just the ending, the entire movie. I love it. Amanda?
Shawshank.
John?
I am going to have to go with the one that I've seen the most. Because I love The Mist, and I think it's a fantastic movie, but I keep on, I'll rewatch Shawshank any given chance.
What up, bitches?
I feel like we just wasted an hour. Can I just say, I find Shawshank to be a great movie, but can you overrate a movie that is great? Because I feel like it's still overrated, even though I do love it. You know what I mean?
I don't think it's overrated.
Number one movie out of 250? Are you kidding
me? Somebody's got to be number one.
But Shawshank Redemption? I wouldn't even put it in my top 20 of all time.
Well,
overrated is the wrong term to call it. Maybe you're just so tired of seeing it every single time you go past TBS.
That's possible.
They did a lot of Green Mile, though. They used to do a lot of Green Mile.
They need more Green Mile because it's a better movie.
It's long and it's
second of it is enjoyable. Where Shawshank, I'm like, God, is he out of prison yet? No, Shawshank's a great movie. I don't want to put Shawshank down. Okay, now listener top three from 3 to 1. It was number 3.
Wow.
I'm actually surprised it's that
2017.
High. Yeah, 2017. We kept TV movies out of it for damn good reason. Number 2 is The Green Mile, and number 1 is The Shawshank Redemption. So it feels like the right movie came out ahead.
So even if Johnny hadn't picked Shawshank and went with The Mist, it would have been 2-2 again, and we would have deferred to listener comments.
But I
and
think it's
still would have
fantastic
won.
That The Mist came out in the final two.
Don't. I think we have some incorrect thought processes going on here.
Now, here I got one more question before we close the show out. Okay, guys, ready?
It's not on the
ready.
Format.
It's not on the format, but I told you all about this earlier, so it's your fault if you didn't pay attention.
I hope I read the message.
What is your personal favorite Stephen King adaptation? Whatever your favorite Stephen King movie is. And yes, you pick one. Troy?
100%. It's The Dreamcatcher. I love it. I watch it every time it comes on. Just to see Morgan Freeman
even Morgan
not being read.
Even Morgan Freeman says, I hate that movie. with his eyebrows.
His freaking eyebrows, man. They're like giant caterpillars on his face.
Ah, my eyebrows are coming for you. They're the dream catcher.
No, honestly, my favorite adaptation, like the most faithful, is Stand By Me by far. I love Shawshank as a movie, but from King's work perspective, I think Stand By Me is by far the best. I would really love to see Frank Darabont, honestly, though, like really tackle Because of the Mist, and it has the same kind of concepts as Under the Dome. I'd love to see an Under the Dome movie done the right way with Frank at the helm. I think that would be fantastic.
That could be better. Yeah, it could be better.
But yeah, Stand By Me.
John, what's your favorite Stephen King adaptation?
You're going to think that I'm trying to be funny.
Okay.
But it honestly is Dreamcatcher.
Is it really?
Are you trying to be funny?
I don't know.
No, I am actually not trying to be funny. I
don't know for the poop scenes.
I don't know why I love watching that movie so much. I like watching the all the guys getting together, and I love how every one of them have their little magic trick that they can do, and like Thomas Jane talking into the gun like it's a phone because Jonesy is calling him, and you know, I just like, I really like it, and it makes me smile every single time I watch it. I'm not being funny, I swear to God.
Okay, I respect if that's your pick.
You know, it's number 25 on the list of most popular Stephen King movies. Like 25. Cell beats Dreamcatcher.
Hey, you know what? Whatever makes John happy.
You know what? No, that's what I was going to say next. I respect that you have such a bold decision here.
I am sending you a Christmas present with an I Done It's t-shirt now.
I Done It's. Oh my God. Don't.
I Done It's.
Don't
tease me.
Yeah.
I Done It. Amanda, what's your
favorite? I will wear the shit out of that t-shirt.
He'll wear it to Christmas dinner. He'll wear it to birthdays, parties. He don't care. I Done It.
He looks like Done It.
One worm, ill world.
Amanda, what's your favorite?
Shawshank.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do really love Stand By Me, and Troy had a really good point with it. And I'm actually reading The Body right now. But when
it's very close.
When I first bought it, I had no idea that was what I figured the book had the same name, but they had to change it because they said it sounded kind of creepy.
The funny thing is that you're still reading it. It's like 80 pages in a PDF. You can do it in like an hour.
No, I didn't start reading it when I bought it. I just picked it up because I have this problem whenever I go past the book aisle at my local store. I buy a book that I don't need to buy. And I saw that one. I was like, oh, that's a really cool cover. I like that. And it's Stephen King. I'm going to give it a shot.
Four Seasons? Or is it actually in a novella? It's like in a pamphlet form.
It's like a paperback book.
Well, that's a small paperback because that's a short book.
It's like, yeah, it's okay. About that thick.
Big letters.
She said it's about that thick for the radio.
A huge font.
What is that, like an inch and a half? An inch?
It's radio. Nobody can see your fingers.
You.
Yeah, that looks like an inch. That's what I tell my girlfriend.
Your wife will be so pleased to hear that.
All right, so
she doesn't listen to the podcast.
That's true. My favorite is, and I'm not trying to make a joke, it's Stephen King's Silver Bullet. I don't know if you guys were.
Ooh, yeah.
Good call.
That's my favorite.
I actually just rewatched that 3 weeks ago.
Did you really?
It's on Amazon Prime. I sat down and I watched that.
Man, I watch it at least once a year. I'm not kidding. At least once a year.
I saw it for
that the first. That has the fine distinction of having one of the second best werewolves ever put the film.
I'm telling you. And the ending is intense, even though it looks like shit now, but it's still really intense, really intense. Just.
I can't feel my legs.
I saw it for the first time. What was it, like two Halloweens ago? Two or three, something like that. And when I first started watching it, I was like, there's no way this is going to be a good movie. Like, I thought it was going to be really cheesy and over the top, but I actually really liked it. And it's totally your kind of movie, Aaron, because you love werewolves.
I do.
Love them.
Let's play Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew chase down the fucking werewolf. Gary Busey's great in that movie.
There is a really, I like, there's one scene stands out to me. They go into like this, what is it, like a barn? Or something, he chases, it goes into the barn with him, and that was a cool scene. I liked that.
Yeah. But this week we wanted to do something a little bit more fun and kind of do a TV theme.
TV!
So we...
I love TV.
So we've had a couple of these film festivals. Like we said, we wanted to just relax and have a good time. So before we get loopy, can you think of any TV crossovers you actually really enjoyed? I was really struggling to think of any
that I actually like.
For real?
Yeah.
Oh, I have like five.
Well, hang on. Let's see.
Johnny will go first.
Yeah.
All right. So what, the one that pops in my head the most that I love so much is the Scooby-Doo episode of Supernatural.
I knew you were going to pick that.
Of course you did. Is that like the only show you still watch regularly? I'm convinced it is.
No. But, you know, I mean, how am I not going to talk about and then, you know, Dean trying to get into Daphne's pants? I mean, come on.
Oh.
These are all things that make sense to me.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't even watch the show, and that was pretty cool. That was a pretty cool episode.
Yeah. Like, how am I not going to talk about that? Another one that comes to mind is, like, Morgan Mindy on Happy Days. That was very cool.
Mm. Well, that was the launching pad, though, wasn't it? I mean, Morgan Mindy, that was kind of like a backdoor pilot. Does that count as a crossover?
I think Morgan Mindy showed back up again at the time.
Oh, okay. All right. That makes more sense. That makes more sense.
What do you got, Amanda?
Okay, so
I've got five.
First and most important is Angel and Buffy, obviously.
Those were some pretty powerful. They used those crossovers pretty well.
They did. They were very
that's
smart
true.
About it.
Okay, that's true. I'll give you those.
Second, which neither of you guys are going to know this, was when Grey's Anatomy had the crossover from Station 19. Mm-mm. I was not on board with Station 19, and I haven't watched Grey's Anatomy still. Okay? Still haven't.
You said, Kay, like John and I are still listening. We stopped after you said Grey's Anatomy.
Anyway.
No, I'm actually searching like the internet for some more crossovers that I forgot about.
So my third one is another one you guys aren't going to know about, is Vampire Diaries and the Originals, because I realized I'm so much more on board with the Originals and these kinds of more adult characters, and it really helped draw me into that world. And then my last one is still very important because it's New Girl, which I love New Girl and Zooey Deschanel, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It was awesome.
That was hysterical.
Wasn't it?
Well, and it wasn't necessarily a crossover, more so like New Girl showed up on Brooklyn Nine-Nine for about 5 minutes, but yeah, that was pretty great.
Well, she needed his help. That's crossover.
No, he needed a ride.
There's two crossovers.
Really?
Shit.
Yeah.
One.
You just got checked.
I must have missed an episode then.
Yeah. While you're on your Google search right now, go find it.
I'll tell
and
you one.
I can come back and be like, with the magic of editing, I suddenly know what's going on.
Right.
I can tell you one, John, you already forgot. I'm actually kind of surprised. Oh. The DC crossovers.
I was going to bring that up.
Oh, yeah, now, because you were out there searching, like, best crossovers ever. Oh, well, DC is the first one.
I also am not going to show up to this party with 15 crossovers in my pocket to be like, look at me. I'm just going to keep talking all night long.
I feel like that was
one
very
slighted. One
very pointed.
You think?
Somebody feeling a little seen right now?
Yeah, I feel a little naked right now.
Did you feel like I do? Because I don't watch those shows, but I did watch the crossovers because they're always really fun. Are you like that?
No, the crossover is like the best thing of those shows. So exactly. Every single time they do the crossover, okay, I'm in.
Do they make sense if you're not watching those other shows, though?
Mostly.
Mostly. They're their own stories.
I never watched the DC ones because I wasn't caught up on the shows. So I was like, well, there's no point in me watching.
As long as you know who the heroes are,
huh,
you can figure the rest of it out.
Oh, well, now I'm going to go watch them.
They're kind of like a way to entice you to check out the other shows.
Smart.
I don't think it ever works, but.
Smart.
Not smart. It never really works because then I might watch another episode of Arrow and then realize that show should have been canceled like 10 years ago. So.
Well, it's getting canceled now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Bye. I've got this is one of my favorite crossovers I've ever seen, is when the X-Files went on Cops.
I knew it.
Oh my God.
That was so amazing. They hope they can get some public support for their research into the paranormal and stuff. And it's like, and they're on Cops the whole time. It's just like, it's the weirdest crossover that should never work. And it was, I believe it was written by Vince Gilligan, who did Breaking
Bad.
No
way!
Yeah. And it's just one of the best, most crossovers I'm not a fan of. I really just don't. I always find it weird. Unless they do something that's just out there. You know, I mean, Law and Order, it kind of works because it's just the exact same show, so you really can't even tell any difference.
But usually I don't really see the point unless you're taking me into something I wouldn't normally watch. And I never would watch Cops. That made me interested in Cops. I'm like, oh, Cops kind of looks fun. Never was. It was never fun as that episode. But it was still got me to check it out. And then there was a Murder, She Wrote, a Magnum P.I. crossover.
That's brilliant.
Do you remember that? Did you ever watch
that?
Yes,
I do.
It was one of those things where they didn't make any sense at all to be together. Like, they just did not make any sense. And it shouldn't have worked in any respect, but it did because Angela Lansbury and Tom Selleck are amazing. And
yeah.
What I don't even know why it worked, but I loved it.
Now, Sci-Fi used to do this crossover from two of the shows, Eureka and Warehouse 13. And watching those was always fun because the way to make those two shows that have nothing in common with each other, where one's about artifacts that are cursed and the other one's about crazy scientific stuff, and to make them both work together was always interesting to watch.
All right, let's get crazy. You guys, we're going to do a little game. We're going to create our own TV shows or create a crossover, basically. But we're going to use our crossovers to make a whole different show. You can cross over any TV property you want. We're each going to do three, but you have to give it a show name. So you're basically crossing them over, giving it a new show name. Got it?
Got it.
Got it? I didn't know I had to sign the terms and conditions here.
Okay. Amanda, you can go first. We're going to go round robin. So one, and then we'll do our second, and then we'll do our third.
Okay. So I'm actually meshing in my first one three different properties.
Okay.
There was no limit.
No, there wasn't a limit.
So I'm meshing Alias, 24, and The Blacklist.
Yeah, you're speaking my language.
Set in the 24 world, Jack Bauer identifies a U.S. terrorist, which just so happens to be someone Reddington from The Blacklist is after. The two FBI teams begin to work together to find this person before their next attack. So they've already made one attack. When the CIA learns of this information, they approach Bauer and Harold Cooper to inform them that they are going to be taking on this case with Sidney Bristow leading the investigation, as this is now an international matter. Now we've got a switch. But after the FBI offers themselves to contribute to the case because of the significance to them, Bristow decides to allow them to assist under one condition. She makes all the final calls. And this show would be called The Caveat.
It's like girl power.
Well, it was just a way to combine all these awesome TV shows that work in the same kind of world, but we never see them obviously interact.
I like it.
And Alias, she gets to lead it because she's so cool.
I have one caveat to your show.
Did I get something wrong?
24 is not the FBI. It's CTU.
Shoot.
That's okay. Well,
I looked up the other ones, though.
Quick change. But I just know people are screaming.
I don't even know what that means, though.
Counterterrorism
unit.
Isn't it all the same anyway?
No.
Okay, so there's the FBI, because I Googled
Jack
some Bauer of this stuff.
Jack Bauer has his own set of rules.
So there's FBI, there's CIA, and then there's, where's this?
It's not a real thing.
Okay, that's why I didn't find it online.
Oh, boy.
I always thought it was just the FBI when I watched it, so.
Anyway. I mean, they always said CTU every single episode.
They did, but I just thought that was like their little division within the FBI.
It is. It's their own division of individual thing.
That's
all
funny.
Right. So I'm going to be very chauvinistic with my first one.
Oh, boy.
You know, it's been a while. Jiggle TV hasn't been a thing in a long time, and I miss it. I'm going to be honest. There's a lot of guys out there who are like, we're not allowed to say it anymore, and I understand, but we miss it. Just like you guys like to watch shirtless guys all the time. We like to watch women in bikinis, right?
I don't mind watching women in bikinis either.
Okay. So there are two things I love. Beautiful, ass-kicking ladies, and Hawaii. Right?
That sounds like a good combination so far.
So I want to combine Hawaii 5-0 with Charlie's Angels.
Ooh.
Three intelligent, fierce, and gorgeous cops are given the freedom from Governor Charlie Garrett to patrol the islands and bring down criminals wherever they may roam with a variety of swimsuit options. It's called Charlie's 5-0.
I'm sold. Still on board.
Yeah. I don't watch either one of those two shows. I'll watch that.
See? Ah, making money. That's how we do it. That's how we do it in Hollywood. Jiggle TV is back.
All right, so my very first one is Parks and the Walking Dead. Ron Swanson leads a park of leads the.
This is great.
Ron Swanson leads the Parks Department during the zombie outbreak. Leslie Knope is an overachieving slaughterer of zombies, effectively protecting the group from zombies, boredom, and red tape and bureaucracy. Andy Dwyer is still a lovable goofball, but he's now a zombie. But he doesn't bite anybody because he's still Andy, and he still just loves everyone. He just like slobbers more. His wife, April Ludgate, still loves him and only him and hates everything else. Tom Haverford creates a business out of managing zombies, and everything is still Jerry's fault because, well, he's Jerry. Even though he's out there with Daryl and Michonne saving the world.
I mean, I was sold when you said Parks.
What are you calling it?
Parks and the Walking Dead.
Parks and the Walking Dead. All right. I would watch that.
Yeah. So sold.
You should probably do it with Walking Dead now. You might get some viewers back.
Well, my second one is combination of Sharp Objects and The Sinner.
Oh, those are two really good limited series.
Mm-hmm. The third season of The Sinner would feature another disturbing murder, a young girl who murdered her sister and two best friends. As a journalist, after hearing about Detective Ambrose's case, Camille Preaker decides to find Detective Ambrose and is asked to assist with the case and cover it. He obviously resists at first, but after she shares her experience with her sister Emma, he finally allows it and the two team up together. And this would be called, okay, so I have two different titles because I couldn't think of anything really clever.
Sharp Sinners?
No. The Luckless Sinner was the first option.
The what?
The Luckless. There's a lot of environmental factors that happen in Sharp Objects that make the murderer in that series shaped by they developed over time and were shaped into that murderer. I guess that's the easiest way to explain it without spoiling anything.
Yeah. I like that.
And the other option for title is Metamorphosis, leading back to that development and changing over time.
I like
The Luckless Sinner.
Metamorphosis.
Oh, really? Better. Okay. Mm. All right.
What is it? Well, John's got a vote.
Okay.
Oh, I'm here still?
You're always
Metamorphosis.
Here.
I like that better.
Oh, okay. I didn't expect you guys to go for that one.
Well, that's what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So my second one, I love the time constraints of 24. So 24 gets two references. Yes.
Dang.
One of the best shows ever on television. And I also love Jack Bauer's intensity. I also love the medical complexities of House and how he would be the only doctor who could solve cases. So I would make House the hospital administrator, and a new hotshot doctor arrives on the scene in the form of former CTU agent Jack Bauer. He's sick of working for CTU. He wants to come work for them. He also has a doctorate. I don't know how he got that, but he got it. Each episode, a patient comes to the Princeton Plainsboro Teaching Hospital with a mysterious illness. House frantically attempts to find the medical cure, while Jack Bauer prefers to find answers in the field by researching similar illnesses and brutalizing former victims for answers. Each week is a race against time to find the cure and see who can get there first. I call it taking it to the house.
That's funny. I like that. I like that he's still interrogating people. Like, I hope he waterboards like a child or something to really push the boundaries.
Chloe, show me the prescriptions.
She's definitely an assistant. Absolutely.
Right. All right. So my next one. Spend the day at the Westworld's weirdest sheriff's office. Who's a host? Who's an actual person having a great vacation? You'll never know. Investigate crimes with robotic Sheriff Holt and his overly animated deputy Peralta, and as they solve crimes such as cattle rustling, stagecoach holdups. Overly built deputy sheriff Jeffries and minuscule Boyle keep fights from happening at places like saloons. This I call Westworld 99.
It's like you're making these shows with my heart in mind. No, you're not.
I don't like 99, so I can't. But I'd watch it just because I like the idea that you're shaking it up there, Johnny. I would watch it.
I would watch it. As soon as I heard Holt, I was like, okay.
I don't even know who those
characters
are.
You know, the twist would be he's not a host.
Interesting.
Yeah, because you would think with his demeanor that he would be a host. He's very robotic
in his And what's your title for that?
Was Westworld 99.
Westworld 99.
Right. It's like a whole little room area. Not room, but one. You know what I mean?
The whole section of the park?
Yeah. That's the right words.
All right. Amanda, what's your last one?
My last one combines Stranger Things and the Umbrella Academy. Number 5 goes back in time to learn about his birth in 1989 and encounter something supernatural and strange. At the same time, the Stranger Things kids are encountering the change after an experiment gone awry. The two collide, and it's determined that the Umbrella Academy was born from the Stranger Things experiment. And I titled this The Beginning.
Huh. All right. Get on board with that. I'm sure John would, because anything Stranger Things, he's like, I'm in.
Yeah, and Umbrella Academy at this point.
You're welcome. I made that for you.
You guys are really loving that much, that show?
The Umbrella Academy? I didn't finish it, so I don't really know. But I thought it would be a cool idea.
Like, you need a second season? Loved it? Or
yeah.
Okay.
No, that is something from Netflix I will take a second season from. Not like The Haunting of Hill House.
You're crazy. I can't wait to see what they do with that.
Me too.
I'm interested to see what they do. I didn't need a second season of it after the first. But now that I hear what they're doing for the second, I'm like, oh, okay, you have me. You have my attention. But like Umbrella Academy, I love those characters. I want to see more from them.
All right. So my last one, I want to merge Jason Bateman into the single greatest series of his career. We're going to take the story, look, and circumstances of Ozark.
Okay.
But instead of that family, it's the Bluth family. trying to stay alive by cleaning drug money in the Ozarks. So you still have George Michael, Bluth Sr., Lucille, Buster, Lindsay, George, etc. Everybody from Arrested Development. And of course, you have their attorney be Barry Zuckerhorn. I just think it would be fun to see the Bluth family navigate that hell. My guess is they'd all be dead in minutes. And I would call it Ozark, colon, in development.
While your title is super clever, an absolute hell no because of Arrested Development.
Because you don't like that show?
I never liked that show.
That's okay. We don't like Grey's Anatomy.
That's okay.
Keep bringing it up.
I barely like Grey's Anatomy myself anyway. That's why I stopped watching it.
So you punished yourself for 14 years until you finally came to the 15th? You know what? I finally realized I like myself more than this.
There was just a lot of emotional trauma you had to
all
deal
right,
with.
So for my next one, my final shot at this, April Ludgate takes a hit to the head, and all of a sudden she sees a sweet, adorable, overly enthusiastic, tiny unicorn. The unicorn is there to help because her husband, Andy Dwyer, is in trouble and needs to be saved from a sadistic monster, Santa Claus, out there kidnapping children and selling them on the black market. This I call happy recreation.
So basically, you only took four shows total for all three of your shows and just crossed them all over together.
Well, I also have Superstore 1 with Lost, and I have a Winchester and Castle 1. I also have those because, like, I don't know. I didn't know how many we needed for tonight.
I thought about doing Moonlighting and Castle.
That's the same show.
Exactly.
You don't have to cross it over. It's the same show.
Shame show?
Yeah, it's a shame show, Sam. See? Yeah. All right. Well, so do we have any listener crossovers that we have? We recorded this early, so there aren't as many as normal, but what do we have?
First up is Tracy Cook. She said, I feel like a good potential crossover series would be Olivia Pope from Scandal crossing over to Parks and Rec. Leslie Knope thinks Pope takes life too seriously and is always trying to prank her.
What is it with Parks and Rec?
It's a great
man.
Show. Spectacular. After the first season is rough. It's like six episodes.
Yeah,
though.
See, you just screwed up. You should have just stopped.
It's only six episodes. Just literally skip the first season.
You cannot win me over with, you gotta watch a season first.
You did that with Breaking Bad for me.
Breaking Bad caught me. Okay, take my words out of it.
All right, so Nate Bruce says, I'd like to see Nick Sachs and Happy from the show Happy to end up in the basement with Jack Malloy and Mr. Floppy and from Unhappily Ever After, just to see the interaction and hear Bobcat Goldthwait and Patton Oswalt titled Horsing Around.
All right. Is that a show, Unhappily Ever After? I don't...
Yeah, it's a like Mr. Floppy was a puppet that would only react when one person was around. Yeah, it's a show.
Is that a sitcom?
Yes.
I don't watch sitcoms. I feel so dumb sometimes because people will talk to me about it and I'm like... Yeah, Night Court, man, that's really the last sitcom I watched every episode of. That's the last one. And that was in the 80s. It's just not...
I forgive you.
It's just not, you know, it's not my thing.
If it's not your thing, it's not your thing.
It's okay. They're not really my thing either, but there's the occasional one that catches my attention, like Parks and Rec or Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
I don't have any interest in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I saw a bunch of episodes and I'm like, Terry Crews
is the only thing. And Andrea Brower, I like him a lot. I just don't like the lead. What's his name?
Andy Samberg.
Yeah, Andy Samberg. He's trying so hard to be as funny as the other ones, and I never find him funny. Now, on the other hand, Parks and Rec, everybody in that cast I love. I've just, you know, watched a couple of episodes. I'm like, I don't get it. But that one I might, if I can just start in season two and I still understand what's going on.
You can.
Okay. Then I'll try that.
When I started watching the show, I watched the first like two episodes and I was like, I'm never going to get to seeing the people that I want in this show if I keep watching this, because I did not like the first season. So I skipped to season two and started watching in season two and finished the series. And then went back to season one and was like, I'll just watch those episodes just to see if I missed anything. And well, really, you don't.
I'll try that again, though, because I don't mind doing that. People seem to love it, and I know they just had a panel, and people are just losing their mind at PaleyFest. So
cool.
That's good news. All right, so the last one, Troy Heinrich says, mad scientist Walter Bishop from Fringe travels between universes in an RV, Breaking Bad, to traffic his new drug line to the other side, since this universe has become tolerant to his drug effects in Bishop's burners.
So it's Breaking Bad mixed with what now?
Fringe.
Oh, Fringe. That's why I don't understand, because I've not seen Fringe.
Fringe is a great show for three seasons, and then it just falls off a cliff.
They took it off streaming, so I haven't watched it.
I haven't finished it. I got through season.
Oh, really?
Almost through season four, and I left it and never came back to it because it just started getting too weird for its own good.
Yikes.
Yeah. All right, that is it. If you are still listening, the website is thehollywoodoutsider.com. We are available on every podcast app you use. And thank you guys so much for listening. Please go to patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider and support your favorite podcast, which I hope is this one, or at least we're in the top 10. Top 5? Top 20? I'll take whatever we can get. Thank you guys so much for listening. Don't forget to come back next week. And remember, the next time you go to the theater to buy popcorn. Wait. No, that's not how that goes. It's been so long. I don't even remember how to do it. What is it? Oh, yeah. The next time you go to the theater or sit comfortably on your couch, because times have evolved, buy popcorn.